Spirit 88.9 FM. We are Catholic radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And today we are delighted to have with us again Mike Aquilino. We're going to spend some time with the Fathers of the Church, a couple of books that Mike has, Fathers of the Church, An Introduction to the First Christian Teachers, and also The Way of the Fathers, Praying with the Early Christians. Mike, morning. Welcome. We're glad to have you back.
Good morning to you. It's great to be back and spend some time with you and your listeners. I always have a good time.
Extreme delight. I think that's what it is, an extreme delight. Just on a side note real quick, Mike, we have to let you know that Bob Lockwood was with us the other day, and we were talking about the different books that are out there to read and what not to read. And his first recommendation to everyone was Mass of the Early Christians by Mike Aquilino.
Well, I'll have to call him and thank him.
How about that?
Bob is the origin of that book, actually, and he's the one who first prodded me to do my Fathers of the Church book. So I probably wouldn't be on this radio show right now if it weren't for a conversation with Bob Lockwood about 15 years ago.
Well, it's high praise. And again, we've had Mass of the Early Christians on our website so that people could just click in and listen to the three segments that you had with us. And people love that.
Yep.
Especially now when we're talking about Gnostic Gospels, and there are people out there purporting to know church history, but they really don't.
It's funny, when the Gospel of Judas turned up a couple of weeks ago, you read the thing and you know why it went out of print almost immediately.
Yeah.
But what was interesting is that it seems that the Gospel is an attack, a direct attack on a church, a Catholic church that already existed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it opens with a parody of the Eucharist.
Mm.
It was indirectly paying tribute to the institution of the church, which was defined by the Eucharist.
Right.
So even these things are valuable to us as we explain the Orthodox faith that we practice today, and that was practiced in the same way back then.
Well, we're so blessed to have you to help us to get to know these wonderful fathers of our church.
Oh, aren't they great to read?
Oh, they so are. And today is the feast day of Saint Athanasius.
One of the greatest of the great fathers.
Yeah,
father of Orthodoxy.
And as you point out, sometimes people are known for who their enemies are.
Right.
And he had pretty extraordinary enemies.
He did have extraordinary enemies in very high places. And probably his most famous enemy was the arch-heretic Arius.
Boo.
Yeah.
Yes.
The founder of the Arian heresy, which was one of the very early and very successful heresies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It immediately won over a large portion of the world, a large portion of the bishops, and certain of the emperors who lived and reigned in Arius's lifetime. Jerome has the great phrase when he describes what was going on in that period. He said, "The world awoke to find itself Arian." That's how suddenly it happened.
Wow.
That's how suddenly heresy just swept through the church and the Christian world.
Which is remarkable when you think about it, because they didn't have the type of communication that we have today.
That's true. You think about the effort that must have been involved. But they say that one thing that Arius and his allies were masters of, and that is politics and diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
They were really good at working things behind the scenes and getting people in the imperial chanceries to get onto their side, and also people in the episcopal chanceries, the church institution. They were very good at kind of infiltrating these places and winning people over. And as usual, the Orthodox were busy just doing their work and not paying attention to diplomacy. And
mm-hmm.
And I think that's how we lose the battle sometimes.
I think you're absolutely right. Can you explain for everybody who may not be familiar with Arianism what exactly that is?
Well, Arianism, again, named after Arius, who was a priest of the archdiocese of Alexandria in Egypt. Arius taught that Jesus Christ was not truly divine in the same way God the Father was.
Mm-hmm.
That in the beginning was God the Father, and Jesus Christ was pretty much the firstborn of creation and was a creature. The Word, mm-hmm. was kind of a second God. Their slogan was, "There was a time when he was not."
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't co-eternal with the Father, and he wasn't co-equal with the Father. And everything he had by grace rather than by nature. So you see, it's something that's insidious. Arius was a very reasonable man, and he put things in very reasonable terms. And his argument was pretty much that three does not equal one. Mm-hmm. You can't say there are three persons and one God, right? And he dismissed the mystery that's the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people bought into that. Mm-hmm. I think he appealed to intellectual pride in a lot of people, and they were willing to buy it.
That type of understanding of God seems to be prevalent in other religions that we experience today, maybe not to the same extent, but I'm thinking of the experience of a Jehovah Witness,
right,
or even Mormonism.
Oh, sure. Jehovah's Witnesses are certainly Aryan. They do not believe that Jesus was divine in the same way that God the Father is and was and always will be. They believe that he's a creature and was elevated to divinity. And this is all what Arius believed. So many of the heresies that we see recurring through history were mm-hmm. right there in the era of the Fathers, and they were dealt with by the Fathers. So if we stay in touch with the writings of the greatest of the Fathers, we'll have a good solid understanding of the faith, but also a good response to a lot of the heresies that crop up down through the ages.
You mean they were doing some writing before Constantine, huh?
Yes, they were. And they believed that Jesus was God long before Constantine, no matter what Dan Brown says in the Da Vinci Code.
That's right. No matter what that guy, Tom Hanks discovers in the film, this has been something that's been passed on for a long time.
Yeah. New day, new heresy.
That's right. What's funny is I really thought it was providential that late last year, those prisoners on the construction crew in Israel turned up what we now believe is the oldest church building ever found, and it's on the plain of Megiddo, uh-huh. near Jerusalem. And one of the inscriptions, perfectly preserved mosaic inscription, and very beautiful too, surrounded by Christian symbols. But the dedication is to Jesus Christ, God. Jesus Christ, the God, it says.
Yep.
So much for that 4th century divinity theory.
So how did Athanasius respond to what was happening with this great apostasy that was spreading in the church?
Well, he was in a good position, really, because he was in the Diocese of Alexandria. He was a very young man, and he was a deacon who lived in the household of the bishop, mm-hmm. Alexander of Alexandria, and Alexander was a mild tempered man and somewhat tolerant of criticism and that sort of thing. And I guess Arius just pushed all the wrong buttons, because he decided that as part of his campaign, he was going to declare his bishop a heretic.
That's never a good idea.
And he did. And Alexander was not pleased with that, and he eventually disciplined Arius and then suspended him from orders. As a very young man, Athanasius was living in the household of Alexander and gradually grew into the very influential position of his theological advisor when he was very young.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that at the Council of Nicaea in 325, Athanasius was only about 25 years old.
Really?
Yes, and so he was the theological advisor to Alexander, who was no slouch himself as a theologian.
Mm-hmm.
And Alexander was really one of the leading voices at the Council of Nicaea. Now, you have to understand, the council was called, this is the first of the ecumenical councils, and it was called by the Emperor Constantine, who was very much concerned that this Arian heresy was breaking up the unity of the empire, which was just newly Christianized.
Mm-hmm.
So he was worried that he really wasn't taking sides in the argument, but he was worried that the divisions were going to cause problems, so he wanted to find a compromise. And he called the bishops together, and the bishops, of course, settled on the faith that we now express more or less in the Nicene Creed at Mass every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this, in a lot of this discussion, Athanasius was very influential. Very soon after the council in 328, Alexander died, And it was his dying wish that Athanasius be made his successor.
Wow.
And the others recognized his gifts. Now, Athanasius was still a very young man. He was not yet 30 years old. And that was against the rules. Mm-hmm. The canon said that you had to be 30 years old. And over time, this would come back to haunt him when people tried to oust him from his diocese. And they succeeded in ousting him from his diocese. He was exiled 5 times. But
wow.
He was a very young man. Now, once he became bishop, he very, very much went after teaching the Orthodox faith throughout his diocese. He traveled a lot made visits through the diocese,
mm-hmm.
and went from place to place to teach the Orthodox faith and to spread the message of Nicaea.
And to travel like that, again, it was not easy. It's not like you could hop in the car and have your driver take you over there.
That's right. That's right. So he had to be carted around Egypt, but he was a hardy man. He disciplined himself. He was in good shape, and he often went to the monks, and he learned his ascetical discipline from the monks. And this would all come to serve him well, because again, he was exiled 5 times. Over his more than 40 years as bishop of the Alexandria, and his exiles totaled actually more than 17 years.
Wow!
And he went as far as Germany. He went as far as France, and he lived in Rome for a while. He always tried to live among the monks and to discipline himself. So, the other thing that's very interesting is that wherever he went, he made more allies. And more influential allies. So his exiles themselves, though they were difficulties for him, they were upward falls, each and every one mm-hmm. of them, because he always made good contacts wherever he went, other Orthodox bishops, and they really strengthened each other, and they learned each other's arguments, and also he went to visit the popes, and then he was able to get the popes very much on his side and in his corner and fighting for him. So these were all great things, even though they were difficulties at the time. And he was able to take that long view. He was very much an optimist. He had amazing confidence that he was doing what was right and that God was in charge. And you see that throughout his career. And I think it's because of that confidence in Almighty God that he was able to keep a sense of humor at all times through a rocky, rocky lifetime as a bishop. You got me going.
Yeah. No, I think that's so important. And for St. Athanasius, I mean, his legacy, not only in battling Arianism and helping to establish what we have come to understand in Nicaea, he really helped the survival of learning just from his influence in the monastic community and what he did for monasticism.
He did. He wrote a best-selling book about it, and it was one of the great bestsellers of the ancient church. That was his Life of Anthony, and what's very interesting is that we know that it had a profound effect on many of the Church Fathers, the later Church Fathers, and by later, I mean even within his lifetime, Jerome and Augustine and many others, mm-hmm. they all say that this was the book that turned them around, or some of them say that they would see young men reading it to one another as they walked here and there. So yes, Athanasius had a great influence on the development of the monastic life because his book, his description of Anthony's life in the deserts of Egypt, became a bestseller in the East and the West immediately. It was a runaway bestseller. It was the Da Vinci Code of its day.
Well, how about that? But filled with truth.
That's right. That's right. Filled with truth.
Could you say he was almost a Plato to St. Anthony's Socrates? And making sure that his ideas were disseminated.
Oh, sure, because Anthony was not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony did battle the Arian heresy as best he could. Sometimes he was always advising. He was always advising the priests and bishops to fight it as ardently. And he was a great opponent of Arius, but he didn't write. He didn't write anything down. He just led his community, and he lived the great witness of his extraordinary life in the desert, and he drew many disciples to him. So Athanasius really enabled all subsequent generations to know Anthony and to learn from his life and to imitate his life.
He must have been extraordinarily intelligent, too, to be able, again, that reflection of that young man, that 25-year-old, the genius he must have had, to be able to write a work that would transcend time and to be able to communicate so clearly this belief of St. Anthony's that it just affected the world, really.
Well, they say he was a prodigy. There were all kinds of legends and rumors going about his childhood, and they say he was discovered by the Bishop of Alexandria when he was a young boy, and the bishop noticed that he and his friends were playing baptism in the sea, and he called them over and he asked them about their game, and they all said that Athanasius was the priest.
There you go.
Doing the baptizing. And the funny thing is that the bishop continued the investigation, and he determined that the baptisms were valid.
Oh. Well, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, you know, who knows?
It was then that he went and talked to the parents of this young child and told them that they had something special here. And as we can tell from his subsequent life, they did have something special, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
I think it's so important that we do learn about the lives of the church of our early fathers. And I think you do it, again, so well with the Fathers of the Church and Introduction to the First Christian Teachers. You have such a beautiful writing style, and you feel like these people are become a part of your family.
Well, my father said I have a great racket going. He always used to tell me that because I just find the best authors who are dead and can't collect royalties. And I disseminate their works, and then I collect the money, he said.
Now, were you baptizing people in the river there when you were younger? Did anybody? I bet you did.
The river, but you wouldn't want to baptize anyone.
Okay.
Stay away from that river.
That's right.
Well, Mike, we want to thank you so much for joining us today on the feast day of St. Athanasius here.
The time went by so fast.
It always does. And we're hoping that you'll be back again with us in June so that we can talk about St. Justin Martyr and St. Irenaeus Lyons.
Right. Well, I'll be back anytime you call me.
Well, good. Be sure. I think we have a Da Vinci request as well.
Yes, we do. You have a new book just out, fresh off the presses.
Right. The Grail Code. It's a history of the Grail legends. And it's something of a response to the claims about the Grail legends that are in the Da Vinci Code, which are nonsense. Mm-hmm. And we make a response to that. People can find out about it online at grailcode.com.
Okay.
That's fascinating. See, that's something that we haven't really focused on. So maybe you could come back in a week or so and we can talk about that. Because I don't think very many of us understand, from what I understand, even Dan Brown hasn't read the Grail Code. So, I mean, any of the Grail stories. So he probably doesn't even know about this.
Well, you check us out today if you get a chance, grailcode.com.
Absolutely.
We will do that. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. We deeply appreciate it, and we look forward to our next conversations.
Thank you for having me.